Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Monday, Pittsburgh-based PNC Financial Services announced plans to purchase Baltimore-based Mercantile Bank shares in an attempt to strengthen its presence in the affluent suburbs surrounding Washington, D.C. Mercantile was one of the last and largest of the state-owned banks in Maryland, and like so many other businesses, will now be a subsidiary of a larger corporation. While mergers such as this are presented as beneficial to the customers they serve, the region loses business leaders who have a personal stake in our community. These civic leaders provide philanthropy to local organizations, making their region a better place to live. Today, we'll discuss what it means to a community when its major financial and corporate institutions are swallowed up by national and international mergers. So please join us with your thoughts after this NPR news break. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this hour. We have all seen the newspapers and read the headlines, and maybe the articles as well, about Mercantile being bought by PNC Financial Services Group, Mercantile being the largest state-owned bank in the state of Maryland, one of the last, I guess, there remain three large banks. There's some smaller ones that are still state-owned. And if you look at the history of Baltimore, we've seen, I think, in our time, as one of my guests wrote in his article, Jay Hancock, six major Baltimore banks have been acquired over the last 20 years. I'll just name them as he did: Loyola, Bank of Baltimore, Maryland National, First Maryland, All First, and Union Trust are all now kind of bought by, swallowed up, however you look at it, by larger banks. And the question is, we also now see what's going on with Constellation Energy and Florida Power and Light. And the question we have here is, what happens when our major financial institutions and last of the major corporations in Baltimore, in Maryland, are then bought by larger national, international corporations? Does it affect us? Does it affect your ability to get a loan? Does it affect their relationship to this community? Is it just the nature of 21st century capitalism? You cannot stop mergers and growth and the buying up of smaller companies. So we'll talk about that and more with our guests this hour. Joining us in studio are Jay Hancock, who is the business columnist for the Baltimore Sun, Richard Clinch. Dr. Richard Clinch is director of economic research at the Jacob France Institute at the University of Baltimore. And David Morris is joining us by phone, who's vice president for the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. And gentlemen, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Nice to be here.
Did I get your titles right?
Nice to be here.
Good. Sure. So making sure I did. And you all can join us. I'd like to hear your comments and thoughts on what these mergers mean for our community, what you think, questions you have about the Mercantile merger with PNC, and what might happen between Constellation and Florida Power and Light, and more. 410-662-8780 and 1-866-661-9309, or write to us at The Steiner Show at WYPR.org. And Ned Kelly, by the way, was going to be a guest on the show, as some people know, but he was advised not to come on during this sensitive period of the merger for legal reasons, and so he said he would come on at a later date, and we'll look forward to having him on the show with us. So, gentlemen, let me just... There are a number of questions here I want to posit before we go to break, and I want our callers to come in here and join this conversation. But let me start with a larger one, then come down to some large community concerns here. The larger question is what I posited for a moment at the top, which is this just the nature of capitalism in the 21st century, that the whole reality or mythology of America being the world of small business and small-town banks and pharmaceuticals and nursing homes or whatever that is, are now a thing of the past? Maybe they never were. That the reality is that mergers are what is the nature of capitalism, that's what happens, and you can really do nothing to stop it or to change it. Maybe you should or shouldn't. Let me start with David Morris, we'll go to Jay Hancock and finish up with Richard Lynch. David?
Well, it is, certainly is the nature of capitalism, not only in the 21st century, but in the 20th century and in the 19th century. Let's remember that the trusts were, in some ways, the birth of modern corporate capitalism in the late 19th century. I would say that it's inexorable, but it's not inevitable. You know, that is that this is a tendency, but it's a tendency that societies get to stop. They get to write the rules related to these kinds of tendencies if they find that they may be harmful. And certainly, 100 years ago, a little over 100 years ago, the country as a whole developed what came to be called antitrust laws. And antitrust laws were developed specifically because at that time people felt that bigness in and of itself was harmful. and that it undermined local businesses, undermined a sense of community, and undermined the connection between the business and the customer. In about 30 years ago, we gave that up. We decided that antitrust could only be enforced if we could prove that there was some economic harm, primarily through a raising of the prices. So I guess the most clear example of that was a few years ago, where the case dealt with Microsoft, which controlled 93% of the market, and it was not considered to be an antitrust violation, at least not a major antitrust violation, because nobody could prove that the price of computers went up or the price of software went up as a result of it. So what you're seeing now play out in Baltimore is something that certainly has gone on in many parts of the country. In fact, I just would close by saying that that although you're feeling the pain now about what's happened with Mercantile, Mercantile, as Jay knows, has itself doubled in size in the last 3 years, and it's done it by acquiring Farmers and Mechanics. It's done it by acquiring Community Bank of Northern Virginia and the James Monroe Bank Corporation. So other communities, in some ways, have felt your pain because of Mercantile, and now you're feeling the pain because of PNC. So there, it is a dynamic that will occur unless somebody, society, establishes rules that says that that it's harmful and we will not allow it to occur.
Jay Hancock from the Baltimore Sun.
I don't think small business has disappeared by any means. That is still the American ideal, and Richard can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think most job creation today still comes from small business.
That's
correct. Is that correct? Small businesses are still out there. Big businesses are certainly there in ways that they never were before. But it's an evolution. You know, it's sort of like the carbon cycle or something. Businesses grow up and become big, and they leave market gaps, and new businesses come in to replace them. A good example of that is First Mariner Bank here in Baltimore that was founded by Ed Hale. He's sort of represents himself as the anti-nations bank, the anti-First Union, and he makes a big deal of that. But it's still a good example of sort of the economic evolution that goes on. The other point I would make is I think we should Mr. Morris says so explicitly, and you, Mark, sort of get at this implicitly, is that this trend towards bigness is something that should be stopped if it can be stopped. I think we should question whether to accept that premise, and I think Richard might have something to say about that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to ponder this, what you just set up.
Yeah.
Richard.
Bigness isn't necessarily bad if it yields economic benefits to the consumer. And in banking, you're bringing economies of scale through these mergers. So the cost of banking will be going down, the cost of services is going to go down, and therefore banking services, you know, can and often do improve. I mean, there's some differences when you look at a company like Mercantile with its community banking emphasis, but by and large, these big banks can offer services at lower cost. PNC's talking about getting rid of the ATM fees. So that's a way that customers can directly benefit from these that are not available to them from a smaller bank.
No, well, I do want to hit some of the very powerful issues for consumers worrying about how this changes their relationship to a bank. But let me bring out what you just said, Jay Hancock. You saw it's explicit in what David Morris said, implicit in how I introduced the show. And whether it is good or bad, if you can even use those terms, for conglomerates to grow and smaller businesses to be taken up by those conglomerates, or if we make too much of that in terms of where the economy and this is going and what it does for jobs and communities, and if it is, in fact, and if there should be anything to limit that, then how would you even begin to think about limiting it? I mean, that I think that would be an issue. Even if you thought it wasn't the right thing, what do you do to limit it? So you raise the issue, Jay. Let me start with you, and then we'll go to David and finish up with Richard.
I don't know how you would limit it, and I'm not sure that you should. I think the negative side effects from these sorts of things can and should be ameliorated by regulation and politicians and government. But I think to stop the trend of aggregation by businesses, big businesses getting bigger, would be very dangerous. I wrote a sort of sentimental column about Mercantile a couple of days ago leaving. And it certainly is a downer for Baltimore. It certainly does remove another source of power, influence, and prestige from the city. But I also wanted to point out that this is the sort of mechanism that contributes to productivity growth and absolute GDP growth in the United States. And if this country is going to pay for Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and a lot of the other social initiatives that we value here, the only way that's going to happen is through productivity growth and GDP growth, because tax revenue is very closely tied to GDP growth, and even small changes in the annual growth rate can make big differences down the road in terms of paying for Social Security. Now, I know I've ignored the idea of raising taxes. Mr. Morris might suggest that we change the tax system and increase tax revenue, and we could do that regardless of the growth rate. But I don't think anybody would argue that that if we shut down the sort of economic action that we see in Mercantile being bought, that we would face, I think, very grave risks. That's not to say that there certainly aren't downsides and losers. I don't want to minimize that at all. People are going to lose their jobs over this merger.
David Morris?
Well, people are going to lose their jobs. According to Mercantile, there'll be $100 million in savings by 2008, and half of that will come from job losses, and I imagine that almost all of that will come on the Mercantile side. From job losses, so certainly people will feel it. I don't think that the question is big, good, or bad is the appropriate question. I think the question is, at what level does big become bad? And apparently your other guests think that there is no level at which big becomes bad. And I think that the evidence, the empirical evidence, is that there's a real danger to bigness. Jay talked about productivity improvements, and I am enormously in favor of productivity improvements. My organization, the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, in fact, is focused almost entirely on productivity improvements. And mergers, the evidence indicates, do not increase productivity. They're not all that efficient, if you look at it from an economic sense. They're all doggone not rational. I mean, the mergers are often driven not by rationality, but by investment bankers or by CEOs with big egos. And the studies have indicated that in the banking sector, for example, these mergers have led to less value for their shareholders. The Federal Reserve has done studies in the 1990s. I haven't seen a more recent one, and they indicated that there are no efficiencies to be gained by having banks, you know, any larger than about $300 million in assets. So when you need to get banks at the multi-billion-dollar level, you're not getting efficiencies there. The Federal Reserve also found that small banks made over 80% of all commercial loans to very small business borrowers. And another study done indicated that the fees for checking accounts and other basic services were higher, not lower, at large multi-state institutions than at small banks.
David,
it does seem to me that when one is talking about productivity improvements, the issue of mergers is not related to that as much as it is to egos and investment bankers' slight fees.
We have to take a short break. We'll be right back. David Morris, you just heard, Vice President for the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, Jay Hancock, business reporter for The Sun, and Richard Clinch, Deputy Director of Economic Research at the Jacob France Institute at UB here in Baltimore. Join us with your thoughts on Mercantile and the mergers facing us here in the city. 410-662-8780, 1-866-661-9309. Tom is the first caller from Annapolis. But right now, we're going to turn this over to Diane Finlayson and Andy Bienstock for just a brief moment to talk to you about why public radio is important to you and to our community. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're talking about the merger of Mercantile and PNC. and other mergers taking place in our community and what they mean for our community. We're talking with David Morris, Vice President for the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, Jay Hancock, who's Business Reporter for The Sun, and Richard Clinch, who's Director of Economic Research at the Jacob France Institute at the University of Baltimore, and your thoughts on what this merger means for our community. Maybe you're a shareholder. Maybe you have your money in Mercantile. Maybe you have some thoughts on where you think this is taking us. So join us at 410-662-8780 and 1-866-661-9309, or write to us at the Steiner Show at WIPR.org. And Richard Lynch, we're going to come to you from break.
I think the issue of who gains from the mergers is important. The shareholders of the acquiring bank don't always benefit financially, as Mr. Morris cited. But I think you got to look here at the shareholders of the banks being acquired. I think here in the past, many Maryland banks were acquired because they were troubled, and those assets were bought at a premium over a troubled price. So the shareholders did better. And clearly with Mercantile, they're getting offered more than the stock has ever seen in its past and is likely to have seen in the near-term future. So the PNC shareholders might not be reaping the full gains here, but clearly the shareholders of Mercantile are.
PNC stock went down.
Down, months. But yeah. Mercantile...
Which is normal for a merger. Usually the acquiring company stock goes down almost.
Let me ask this other question that came up, the conversation we had during the break, and David Morris, you and the listeners were not privy to this. Let me just throw out a synopsis of it and talk about this for a minute. One of the things we talked about is why Mercantile sold. I mean, A, it's a bank that's doing very well, not like other banks that have been sold for the most part in our community that were made bad decisions and got sold on the way down to the bottom. But Mercantile is a very strong bank. We had Furlong Baldwin, a longtime leader of that bank, there's clearly no love lost between Ned Kelly and Furlong Baldwin in this process of taking over Mercantile when the hands transferred over to Ned Kelly. But Baldwin, when he was on the show, was very clear about mergers are not in the best interest of our company, and I've always fought them off and decided not to do them because we're a strong bank and I didn't think anybody was stronger than we were. For our clients or for our shareholders, so why should I sell this bank? So the question is, you have a strong bank. We saw that Ned Kelly said he didn't take a parachute, but as one of my guests here said, we don't know what that means, what else he's getting in terms of stock options or anything else. That's not public knowledge at the moment. So the question is, why sell? Why was Mercantile sold if it's in such a strong position and such a great community leader and the old Blue Blood Bank of Baltimore? So your thoughts about that, and would you like to start, Richard, then we'll go to Jay and end up with David and go right to the phones?
I think the reason they're selling is because of the consolidation in banking is occurring because of changes in federal regulation that allowed it, which is driving this whole consolidation in the banking industry. And because of the strength of Mercantile's reputation and business here, it is a very strong bank. It's a very strong target for acquisition, especially for a company like PNC that wants to expand in the Middle Atlantic and acquire a premium property and is paying a premium for that.
Jay?
Yeah, I think that's the standard explanation, and that's the explanation that that any banker doing this kind of deal would give you. We don't know what the real motivations are. We can't tap into Ned Kelly's head and the head of the board of directors of Mercantile. But presumably, they see value for their shareholders, who are their bosses in the long run, in the offer that PNC made, and they see value there that they presumably didn't think they could have gotten on their own by running the bank on their own. PNC is paying cash and stock for the Mercantile shares, which were valued the day before the merger at about $47 and change, I think. Now, PNC stock has gone down a little bit since then, which takes that valuation down, but it's still a ton more than what Mercantile was trading for before the offer, which I believe was in the 30s, right, Richard?
High 30s, mid 30s.
So the answer is they see value for their shareholders, and it's a free country, and capital moves around, and that's what happens. Now, I think it's also fair to say that Ned Kelly probably did not believe as firmly and strongly as Furlong Baldwin did that this was an institution that was important to the community, that had a heritage, a rich heritage, and one that needed to stay headquartered in Baltimore for the future. Now, the question is, by holding that view, was Baldwin doing a disservice to his shareholders? The argument you can make, I think, is clearly no. His shareholders did extremely well. Mercantile stock has done better than virtually every other bank in the country over the last 20 years. So, you know, Baldy had his cake and ate it too. He kept the bank local, and he did great by his shareholders. It becomes more difficult to do that over time. Perhaps the present Mercantile management just decided that it was time to take their chips off the table.
David Morris, same issue.
Well, yes, I mean, Ned Kelly came in, I believe it was in 2001. I mean, so he doesn't have a long history.
That's correct.
Right. With it, you know, someone made him an offer he couldn't refuse, and actually, by law, it may very well be that he couldn't refuse it. I mean, the shareholders could have sued. There is a certain level of premium that you pay for, that someone is willing to pay for your shares, that the shareholders can go to court, and they have gone to court. And court and state courts. I mean, we should remember this, that the law itself is that the CEO is there and the board of directors are there to maximize their shareholder value and assets. They're not there to help the community. They're not there to help the workers. They're not there to provide good services. They're there to maximize the asset value of their shares. And the shareholders can sue them. If they're not doing that, often you find that there are strong institutions that are taken over. Often you have hostile takeovers, where at least the management of a given corporation thinks of it itself as being strong. But you know, Richard, I think, put his finger on it here. Well, he says federal regulation changes allow this, and in fact encourage it. And we should, you know, once again realize that we make the rules. In some ways, the rules make us, which is why we call our website New Rules, oneword.org. So we unchange those rules that would not have encouraged this. The same thing occurred in electricity. I mean, BGE is being taken over, and it's going to allow it to jack up its electric prices because of the rule changes that occurred at the federal level and at the state level, but primarily at the federal level, around deregulation. In telecommunications, we changed the rules in 1996, and a massive wave of consolidation occurred in the media after that. And a recent study, just the last couple of weeks, came out, indicated the profound harm, if you will, to local communities in that these emerged radio stations, they were focusing on radio stations,
right,
had a significantly reduced amount of local news. And that would, of course, be sensible, if you will, when management is far away and it's absentee-owned. So, yes, we make the rules, and the rules make us. And as you indicated, this is a strong bank with high productivity, high efficiency, good community connections. I think that it would be a stretch to say that anyone is going to benefit from this except the existing shareholders of one side of the institution.
Let me go to the phones here. As we just heard from David Morris, Vice President of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, also joined by Richard Clinch, who is the Director of Economic Research at the Jacob France Institute at the University of Baltimore here, and Jay Hancock, who is a business reporter or columnist. How are you?
Columnist.
Columnist. Well, I thought you were, yeah, for the Baltimore Sun. I take this reporter and scratch that and put columnist in. 410-662-8780 and 1-866-661-9309. Write to us at the Steiner Show at WYPR.org. Your thoughts on the mergers taking place in our community, whether they are good or bad for us, what we look for in local businesses, do they enhance our community? Do we need larger institutions to enhance the business nature of our country and our local area? And we're then going to begin to explore, when we come back from these phone calls, about whether mergers hurt or help the access to capital, and do they change the nature of our relationships to the officers and to those banks itself? Let's go to Tom in Annapolis, first caller up.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Tom.
I just want to say that Mr. Hancock, in reading some of his articles, particularly over the summertime, about how the merger with BGE, Constellation Energy, and Florida Power is a bad deal for Maryland consumers, there was a nice article in The Sun by Dr. Basu just this week that talked about how it would benefit customers, consumers here in Maryland. However, it seems like if we don't get some different political leadership, we're going to be driving a lot of Maryland-based companies out of the state, and Mr. Hancock will not have much to write about.
Jay?
Well, I can respond to the caller and to David Morris at the same time, I guess. I think not all bigness is bad. I do agree that we need to pay attention to the rules that we as a civil society set through our legislatures and city councils to regulate the way we live and do business. But I think we need to distinguish between what industries we're setting rules for. And I've argued in the paper, and I'll repeat it here again, that electricity is fundamentally different from banking or oil or telephone calls or other sorts of products that we consume. It is, first of all, it's a fundamental economic input for an economy. It is just absolutely crucial. It is also very close to something like a human right in modern society. Electricity is just necessary to have a first world life. And it's a monopoly. So, you know, there's only one company selling us electricity here. It's called BGE. So I think we need to regulate the heck out of it. I don't think the three or four qualities that I just mentioned apply to banking. Banking's not a monopoly, neither is telecommunications.
Take a short break. We'll be right back. We're going to turn this over for a few minutes to Andy Bienstock and Diane Finlayson to talk about the importance of a locally owned business called WYPR, your public radio station, and why you should support it. Then we'll go to Frank in Ellicott City and explore the idea about whether banks hurt our access to capital when they merge. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back as we look at the mergers in our community being faced by perhaps a merger between Florida Power and Light and BG&E, Constellation Energy, excuse me. But what we're faced with right now is a merger between Mercantile and PNC Financial Services and what that means for this community. Number here is 410-662-8780 and 1-866-661-9309, or write to us at The Steiner Show at WIPR.org. We're talking with Richard Lynch, who you just heard. Jay Haycock is who we just heard. Yeah, but Richard Lynch is Director of Economic Research at the Jacob France Institute at the University of Baltimore. Jay Hancock is the business columnist for the Baltimore Sun. David Morris is Vice President for the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. And Frank and Ellicott City are on the air.
Yes, first of all, I'd like to say I've been through either three or four bank mergers in terms of my accounts, and not one of them has been advantageous to me. But all of them have ended up costing me money.
How so?
Because the fees were increased. The reasons I went to the previous bank either didn't exist anymore or fees were added or increased for whatever I was doing. Secondly, it's becoming more and more difficult to change banks because of electronic funds transfers. I have nothing against them, but if you are having a lot of funds taken in and out of your accounts, you better have twice the amount of money that you need in order to successfully get your electronic funds transferred in and out of both accounts and to have them seized. The next to the last time that I had electronic funds taken care of, it took over 12 hours of my time to get it straightened out, plus the risk of getting in trouble with people I owed money to because not all the electronic transactions were taken care of. So I think it's getting harder and harder to switch banks, or let's put it this way, less and less convenient, perhaps, whatever, to switch banks. These types of things show productivity increases for the bank, electronic transfers and things like not getting your states, your checks back.
Mm-hmm.
But they cause, if you have a problem, they cause a loss in personal productivity, for which there is no measurement. It's just like managing your own medical problems. You can spend days and days and days on that filling out forms, and none of that hits productivity in terms of whomever you're insured with.
That's a great point.
Jay.
So anyway, those were more or less my 2 points.
Thank you so much, Frank. They're good points. And Jay, sure. Then we'll turn to David Morris.
Well, he's right about it is more difficult to change banks now that we have our paychecks deposited into our accounts and our bills paid out of our accounts. It's a big hassle to change, and that's what banks are counting on. There's a big inertia factor there, and when they raise fees, they're assuming that you're going to make the calculation that it would cost you more to go through the hassle of changing to a new bank than just sitting there and accepting the new fees. And my advice would be, don't be complacent. Take the initiative. Yeah, it'll take time, but go find another bank if you don't like the fees.
And write checks, don't do transfers.
That's another idea.
I still am a check writer as opposed to that. David Morris, thoughts before we move on to another subject here?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, and it's almost a universal point. I mean, you ask anybody who's been through a number of bank mergers and see whether it's become either lower cost or more convenient, and they will giggle. In the old days, that is in the 1980s, before this current trend started with banks and also with the basic deregulation of savings and loans, the argument was, the economies of scale argument was, that one bank that seizes a number of other banks would eliminate a lot of board of directors, it would eliminate a lot of overhead, it would eliminate a lot of duplication of paperwork, and so therefore it should almost certainly be cheaper in the way it could provide services. And then they checked, and they found out that it wasn't. And the question then is, well, you know, why not? And what they found out was that, in part, their defaults went up, the default ratio went up, and in part it was because your local bank, and here I'm talking about smaller banks, mm-hmm. Knew their customers. And so in that sense, there was a less overhead attached to deciding whether somebody was trustworthy, if you will, whether they would give their money back. I mean, pay their loan back. I think that bigness may be a necessary evil, but the question in my mind, really for the other two guests, is who should the burden of proof be on? And I would argue that the burden of proof is on those who want to get bigger, rather than on those who don't want them to get bigger, because inexorably, if you get bigger, it means that you separate those who make the decisions from those who feel the impact of the decisions. You separate those who get the benefits from those who feel the costs. You separate the provider of the services from the customer of the services. Those things are inherent to bigness. They may be worthwhile, but certainly it would seem to me that the burden of proof should be on those who want to get further away from their customer base.
We let Richard Lynch have a stab at this.
Well, I think it is up to the customer to make these decisions. It's up to it is a market economy, and this is a market provided service. And I think clearly Ed Hale has made his fortune based on the fact that there are a certain number of people who want a small local bank and are willing to, you know, take their money when their bank gets acquired and put it into one of his banks. So I think if it doesn't pass the customer service test, then customers will leave. Admittedly, it is difficult. But you know, this is a free service or a free market service. They can move banks.
But how does it change the nature of our relationship to the bank? In other words, the mergers hurt local access to capital. Our small businesses and people looking to buy a home are going to find more difficulty dealing with access to capital out of a large international bank or a bank owned like First Mariner or Chevy Chase or Provident, which are locally owned, or any of the number ones that we can think of that are locally owned banks. And does that change the nature of our relationship to the people who work at those banks, to the bank offices themselves, even to larger institutions or smaller ones? I mean, one of the things Furlong Baldwin said in the show was, he said, you know, I hate classical music, but I'm on the board of the symphony because it's my responsibility as president of my local bank to be part of that, as part of one of our community institutions. So does that change the nature of things? Jay, and then David, and go over to Richard.
It does change the nature of things. One of the downsides for Baltimore in this trend is we will lose people who hate whatever cultural institution they're sponsoring but feel like it's their duty to do so anyway. That is a downside. Another thing we lose that's overlooked a lot of times is community leadership, not in a charitable philanthropic sense, but in an agenda-setting political sense.
Mm-hmm.
Baltimore, for most of its short 200-year-old life, had a very active, deeply caring business community that helped point things in the direction that business leaders thought it should go. You can call it elitist, but it really made Baltimore largely what it is today. I guess the most recent big manifestation of that is just how Don Schaefer and the business community, the BDC, got together in the 70s and 80s to start the downtown revival. I am not aware of, I don't get the sense that there's a significant and traumatic loss of access to capital when these mergers happen. But David has probably looked into it more and may have other information.
David, in the brief time you have left, why don't you grab that?
Yes,
for a minute?
Well, I had mentioned before that the Federal Reserve has looked into this. There's a 1996 study, I don't know, more recent, and they found that small banks, in fact, make over 80% of all commercial loans to very small business borrowers. And they do that because they're small and they can handle small, whereas the larger that you get, the more you're really looking for very large accounts and very large loans. I mean, the reason that that banks are merging at the international level is because they want to say to the big business locally that they can handle their accounts in Hong Kong, and they can handle their accounts in Belgium. And God bless them for doing that, but that has nothing to do, really, with their, you know, with their communities. I think that what we're talking about here is a sense of community and a sense of place and a sense of rootedness and the tension. And there's a natural tension between that and the dynamics of the marketplace and entrepreneurialism and investment capital, which is very fluid. And that's why I repeat, we establish rules related to that. And the rules related to that then put some brakes, if you will, on private interests and very small, narrow interests, and try to serve a larger social interests. If I may, in the 1930s, when those chain stores came in, some states introduced what they called a branch store tax, which I think was marvelous, which said basically, if you had over a certain number of branches, now these were grocery stores primarily, over a certain number of branches, that they would increase the tax rate, that is the state tax rate, gradually, depending on the number of branches you had. They wouldn't ban these stores from getting bigger, but they recognized that there was a social cost involved in their getting bigger because of their influence on other big businesses, because of their dislocation from the customer, and because of their growing political influence in the state legislature. So what they said is, we're going to impose a penalty. And what I worry about in 2006 is we're saying just the opposite, that the community bears an enormous burden of proof in order to even slow down this merger frenzy.
Okay, we have sort of a truncated show today because of the fund drive, but very quick, about 30 seconds worth, let me turn to Richard Lynch.
I think access to capital has two elements. Who gets the loans and what they pay for the loans? A community bank like Mercantile does probably a better job because they can reach out and know the businesses to who gets the loans, but then what you're paying for the loan will fall because of the efficiencies gained from a larger bank.
I think where you end up is an interesting discussion to have maybe another day, which is the marketplace and regulation and where the two fit for the future of a society. And I think that'd be an interesting thing for us to debate one day. I want to thank you for being here today. Richard Lynch, Jay Hancock, David Morris, thank you so much for taking your time to talk to our listeners today.
Nice to be here.
The Mark Steiner Show is produced by Marcus Charles and Jessica Phillips, direct engineered by John Ahrens. Additional help from Jason Schuster. I'd like to thank Sophie's Crepes next door to Charles Theater for providing lunch for our guests. And the Mark Steiner Show is podcasting, so go to WYPR.org to download our programs. And right now we're turning this over to Andy Bienstock and Diane Finlayson to talk with you about the importance of this local institution during our on-air fund drive. Thank you so much for listening.